I know you're out there. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
The Chris Ann Hall Show.
Any varmint that crosses that lady's path has met its match. Come on!
Rise and shine, liberty-loving patriots. Welcome to the Chris Ann Hall Show. Chris Ann Hall here, KRISANNEHALL.com. So glad to be here with you today. So glad to be a part of your day. And I hope that you will indulge me. You know, we are liberty over security, principle over party, truth over your favorite personality, and that a large portion of my teaching is hinged around this understanding of history. Patrick Henry said, I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that's the lamp of experience. I know no way to judge the future but by the past. And we teach history so that we can know the future. And the irony is that government steals history from us so that we don't know the future. So we are doomed to repeat those mistakes that always give them more power. And so I hope that you will indulge me in a little history lesson today, because it is a very, very, very important lesson that we need to embrace today. It's a history we don't want to repeat, playing out right in front of our faces. Now, to make a long story short, the history of our Constitution is a history of a British law and British Constitution. Because you remember, everybody who lived in the American colonies were subjects of the Crown of Great Britain, subject to British law, but also entitled to the rights of Englishmen as codified in their Constitution. The Constitution, which was built of five documents spanning over 700 years. And that history of that 700 years is such a brilliant snapshot on what government looks like, on how government and people interact with each other. And the natural human nature tendencies for government to always want to be kingdoms and for people to always want kings and to be provided for, because people love free stuff. And so it is throughout human nature. I don't know if it's a matter of natural law, but it just seems to be a matter of this natural human nature to start off with freedom, with liberty, with independence, and sort of devolve into servitude. You see, liberty always brings prosperity. Tyranny doesn't bring prosperity. Tyranny always brings desolation. It always brings strife, and it always brings a revolution at some point. But liberty always brings prosperity. Prosperity is the biggest enemy to liberty. Isn't that interesting? The one guaranteed result of liberty is the one thing that is guaranteed to bring its demise. Because you see, when a people become prosperous, they become pacified. They become lazy in luxury. They become complacent and compliant in their comfort. And in order to maintain our liberty, we must be jealous of our rights. We must diligently and vigilantly guard our rights from government. That's the biggest enemy to liberty, besides prosperity, is government. Government and liberty are enemies of each other. Prosperity brings the demise of liberty, but government and liberty are enemies. Because, you see, government always wants more power, and the more power government has, the less liberty have. So government loves prosperity. Because government, when a nation is prosperous, government knows that the people will fall asleep, and then that's their time to move. And they can come in and start taking charge and care of the people. And in order to take charge and care of the people have to give more power to government. You see how this works? It's this whole circle that literally where the odds are stacked against us, because it takes work to maintain liberty. It takes work. Now, I want to give you this little history lesson after giving this this backdrop of our liberty, the establishment of our liberty, and the establishment of our constitutional republic. 700 years, 5 documents. In 1066, the Anglo-Saxons of our constitutional history had a king named Edward the Confessor, and they loved Edward. But Edward was about to die. And he had no heirs. So that means that the throne would then pass on to a cousin who was next in line to be king. The next in line to be king was a man named William the First. William the First, come on now, be honest. Becoming king was no surprise to him. If you are next in line to be king, you are waiting for someone to die because no one is going to pass up the opportunity to be king. Well, I can't say no one. George Washington did, didn't he? Well, with very few exception, people will not pass up the opportunity to be king or queen. Because even the best person, with the best intents, could say, you know, if I had that power, we could do so much. We could change the world. We could fix this problem. Because you see, I have this idea and I know these people and we could pull these people together and we could do this. If I just had the resources that I need. And as king or queen, your resources would be veritably unlimited. And so William knows he's about to be king. The problem is, the Anglo-Saxons do not want William to be their king. Because William is not Anglo-Saxon. William is Norman. Anglo-Saxon kings operate in a unique style of monarchy called a limited monarchy, where the Anglo-Saxon kings are limited in their power by the consent of the people, the common law. Norman kings operate under a foreign law, a law completely different than the Anglo-Saxon common law, and their kings are unlimited in their power. So these Anglo-Saxons do not want William to be their king. They do not want a foreign leader over their kingdom because they know foreign leaders always bring foreign law, foreign rule, and rule that is contrary to their beliefs and their standards. Well, the bad news for the Anglo-Saxon people is this. William is not going to stand by and allow the Anglo-Saxons to deny him his rightful heir to the throne. The Anglo-Saxons are going to try to appoint a man named Harold Godwinson to be king. Like I said, the year is 1066, and you don't appoint kings and you don't elect them. And so with the appointment of Harold Godwinson as king of the Anglo-Saxons at this time, this sets up a very, very volatile situation. Because William knows he is the rightful heir, and he's not going to stand back and let this happen. It's my time. It's my time to become king. It is my right to be king. And I will not be denied. William also has a nickname. He's called William the Conqueror. And He is now going to live up to his name, raise his Norman army. He's going to go over and defeat Harold and the English people and make himself king. Now, William has no intention of ruling in a limited fashion. He has no intention of taking up this Anglo-Saxon throne. He has every intention of transforming the Anglo-Saxon community into a Norman one. What he's familiar with, what he knows, what he likes, what gives him the most power. And so, he raises up his Norman army, he goes over and defeats Harold and the English people, he makes himself king. But he also realizes something. Kings have to worry about keeping their heads. Now, he has just conquered these people to become king, which means he is not popular in the eyes of the masses. And if he were to step up right now as the newly crowned king by force and declare, by decree, that the Anglo-Saxons would no longer operate under Anglo-Saxon law, that they will now operate under Norman law, under this foreign law, they will now operate under a Norman king and not an Anglo-Saxon king. He knows that he is very, very likely looking at a violent rebellion that will end in the loss of his head, and all his efforts will be in vain. So William, being a wise man, or perhaps just simply having wise advisors, decides that instead of simply standing up and announcing that we will now be Norman in rule and law, that it would be better to fundamentally transform the kingdom over a period of time in a slow and methodical way, so that the people do not even recognize that their kingdom is transforming into foreign rule and foreign law. And if they don't notice, they can't stand up in opposition, and they will simply, in their complacency, comply with the rule of law, regardless how foreign it is.
She's Liberty's lobbyist.
So we have a situation now where William is king and he must transform the kingdom into foreign rule without the people noticing. Now this transformation is literally going to take place over a period of 40 years. Now the thing that limits William the most is the common law. The Anglo-Saxon law. William doesn't like Anglo-Saxon law. William likes his Norman law, which is foreign law to the Anglo-Saxons. So how do you change the legal system of the land without actively and brazenly rewriting the laws? Well, William knows. You simply replace the judges in the legal system with judges who are not loyal to the law of the land, but loyal to the law of the king and the ideologies of the king. And then you can use those judges to reinterpret the common law of the land and bring in the foreign law and start applying that on the people of the kingdom through the judges. Oh, the judges are issuing a ruling. Well, you know, they have the power to interpret the laws. And as they're interpreting the laws, we must, as a civil society, uphold the interpretations of the courts and these laws. Well, you know, it's very strange, these statements that our judges are making lately. These statements of, well, you know, we really need to look to foreign law for better advice. I don't understand. We are a kingdom here with sisterhood and brotherhood with kingdoms all around us. Our king, after all, is from a kingdom just next door to us. Wouldn't it make sense to use the wisdom of our neighbors in solving our legal issues and discerning our societal problems? But the people don't question the judges. The people trust that justice is blind and that our courts are neutral and not biased. So William uses these judges who are loyal to his foreign law to incorporate foreign law into the common law system. Now, this is not going to go over well for a very long time. So William has to keep working to fundamentally transform, because you see, there's always a tipping point. They keep applying this foreign law, and the people are going to start pushing back eventually. So you're going to have to do something to keep the people from pushing back on the application of this foreign law. Because I guarantee, when they started off with this, the people are always like, wait a minute, you can't do this, this is not our law. And no matter how much the judges rationalized, there were people who dissented, the people who disagreed. Now, they were not enough in numbers, and they were not bold enough to stand. They're like, well, you know, this isn't quite right. But we will trust the judges for now. We'll see what happens. And so to keep the people from pushing back in rebellion and chopping off William's head, then we must do something else. So the next step, after you replace the judges in the court system with judges who are loyal to the foreign law, you must now apply this foreign law to the people in such a way that you diminish their property rights. You have to start chasing the people off of their land with the force of law and the force of government. Because William knows that when land becomes abandoned in a kingdom, the ownership of that land reverts back to the king. So he is going to use these judges with their foreign law and with the force of government, sometimes even physical force of government, to chase the landowners off their land, sometimes completely out of the kingdom, so that he can now take possession of their land. And what is he going to do with the possession of that land? He's going to start inviting all his foreign friends over to live in the kingdom. How else do you keep a rebellion from happening over a foreign law? Unless it's filled with the people who like the foreign law better than the common law of the land.
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
So William has traded out the judges. The judges are actively applying foreign law on the land within the kingdom, upholding the ideologies of the king and this foreign law, even when it's contrary to the law of the land. And they're using that law to drive the landowners out of the kingdom and off of their land, so that now we can bring all these foreign people into the kingdom who like the foreign law. Because if you going to keep a rebellion from happening, you've got to make sure the majority of the people in the land like the way things are going. So you need to bring people in that like the foreign law. And so that's what we'll do. William also understands that the church is very powerful in this era. And so now we're not only going to change out the judges and change out the law, we're going to change out the leadership in the churches with men who are not loyal to the word of God, but loyal to the ideologies of the king. And so now the king can use the church to convince the people to do things, even when it's contrary to their law, even when it's contrary to their faith, even when it's contrary to the word of God. So now he can bring these church leaders into the church and say, hey, we really should be supporting this foreign law. We really should be supporting this king bringing all of his foreign friends in to own and occupy our land. That's what we ought to be doing. And this transformation takes place, like I said, over about 40 years. And will result in a coup of the government. We don't get a rebellion this time around in 1100 when William the First's son, William the Second, takes over and continues reigning in the same manner that his father did. A coup is organized, and William the Second is killed in a mysterious hunting accident, which makes his brother king. Henry becomes king, and he realizes that the people are not going to tolerate the methods and the means of his father and his brother. And so he makes a promise to the people in the 1100 Charter of Liberties that government will never be evil and oppressive again. That's not going to last. But that's all the further we're going to go in this history today. Because I want us to look at this. America, you have a foreign president. Barack Obama is the stinking poster child for why our framers required a natural-born citizen to be president of the United States. He is the very epitome of every argument against having a president who has one parent who is not an American and one parent who is. He is the very reason why you cannot allow a president to have fractionalized loyalty to another country. And he is doing the same thing that William the First did. Barack Obama has said on many occasions, professed his loyalty to Islam in his book, which book is this? The Audacity of Hope. On pages, a passage from page 261, he talks about having sympathies with the Arab and Pakistani Americans, having support for the persecution, or having support for them in face of the persecution that they face in light of 9/11. He says, they need specific reassurances that their citizenship really means something, that America has learned its lessons from the Japanese internments during World War II, and that I will stand with them, the Arabs and the Pakistani Americans, the Muslims. I will stand with the Muslims should the political winds shift in an ugly direction. Now that all sounds pretty benign and actually a little bit constitutionally true, because the Supreme Court standing for the internment of Japanese Americans and the things that we have done to people in the name of national security who are citizens of this country is actually pretty ugly. It's not something we want to repeat. But when you take that in light of the fact that he has a disproportionate support for Muslims than he does for Christians. He actually openly berates Christians, mocks the Christian Bible, while upholding the Quran and defending the Muslims. You have a Muslim boy who makes a clock that looks like a bomb, and he is arrested and suspended from school. The president immediately tweets out his support for this young man and invites him to come to the White House. But yet we have Christian children who are suspended from school for refusing to do things based on their Christian beliefs. We have American children who are suspended from school for wearing American flag t-shirts in America on Cinco de Mayo. We have American children who are suspended from school for making a Pop-Tart look like a gun. And yet they get no support from the White House. They get no invitations, no tweets. I think this president has been done more to show us his loyalty is not with America and with American culture. And he promised to fundamentally transform. And so now we have a court system where our judges are openly embracing Islamic law. Oh, they call it foreign law. Well, it's just generally foreign law. But no, we are watching Sharia law being integrated into our federal court systems. We have a Supreme Court Justice Breyer who just wrote a book professing that we ought to look to foreign law more often to solve our domestic issues. We have the government seizing up more and more land from the American private landowners in the name of resource preservation, in the name of environmental security, in the name of land management, and using the courts and the force of government to do this, regulating people off of their private land, creating federal lands all over the country. And now, the Americans are going to be coerced into accepting tens of thousands of Muslim refugees into our country without any background checks, without any security issues, without anything. We're calling them refugees. Their countries are even saying these people are not refugees. They are rich Muslims who simply want to come to America. We are going to take tens of thousands, upward of more than 100,000 Muslim refugees, more than any other country in Europe, and more than other countries in Europe combined. And we are going to accept these people in huge numbers into our country without any qualifications, without any distinction, that they will submit themselves willingly to the law of the land. People who have been born, raised, and bred into believing the Sharia law and their foreign law is the right thing to do. And now they're going to populate our land in masses. They're going to be spread out throughout the country so that now they can influence our government and maintain this movement of foreign law in our country. And then enter in the Pope, who is now telling everyone that we have a duty to bring these immigrants, these undocumented refugees, into our country. It's very interesting. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Christians literally being persecuted to death across the country. And we don't see this massive outpouring of aid and sympathy for them. But we have this massive movement of Muslim refugees into America. A foreign king who wanted to fundamentally transform a kingdom, replacing the judges in the kingdom with those who liked the foreign law, and will now enforce the foreign law in the kingdom even when it's contrary to the law of the land, using that law to chase the private landowners off of their land so that they have more room for their foreign law-loving friends to come live, taking control of the church, establishing leaders in the church who are loyal to the ideology of the king above and beyond everything else. When will we understand what George Washington said, that foreign influence is the most baneful foe to Republican government? Will we have to suffer great persecution before we wake up? Or will we learn from history?
My right to tote the weapon of my choice. Don't censor my voice. Hate me if you won't, or love me if you can. If the truth is what you want, then you found your man. I ain't backing down, I ain't backing up. If you think like I think, then crack it on up.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stay on my ground. Take my job, but not my gun. Tax my shit till I ain't got none. Here for the good Lord up above.
Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
George Washington, in his farewell address of 1796, said, "Against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, I conjure you to believe me, fellow citizens, the jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake, since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of a republican government." Washington knew from his history the real dangers of foreign influence. Part of Washington's British Constitution was a document called the Grand Remonstrance of 1641. In which the people of Great Britain listed many grievances against their king, Charles I. They indicated that these grievances were indicative of a larger design to overturn and undermine the liberty of the people and the law of the land. And one of those grievances illustrates how foreign influence and foreign law have contributed to the destruction of liberty. Quote, "Such counselors and courtiers, as for private ends, have engaged themselves to further the interests of some foreign princes or states to the prejudice of His Majesty and the state at home." In another part of the British Constitution, the English Bill of Rights, the people of Great Britain actually require an oath of their king and his council to shun all foreign influence. Quote, "And I do declare that no foreign prince, person, prelate, state, or potentate hath or ought to have any jurisdiction, power, superiority, preeminence, or authority, whether ecclesiastical or spiritual, within this realm, so help me God." Because they knew, through 700 years of kings behaving in the same way William I did over and over and over again, that foreign influence will always destroy liberty. Protecting the United States from foreign influence was obviously very prominent in the minds of our framers, especially in the office of the president. And at the time of the creation of the Constitution by the states, there were no natural-born citizens. so an exception was made until the qualification could be met. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 reads, "No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of the President." The exception to the natural-born citizen requirement was that the President must be a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. We know that was so they would ensure that the people who were patriots of the Revolution would be the ones considered for this office. We need to understand that the whole reason that the President, the Commander-in-Chief, must be a natural-born citizen, a child of two-parent citizens, is so that we do not have this threat of foreign influence in the hands of the President of the United States. And here we are. The entire reason for establishing the criteria for the President to be a natural-born citizen was to help eliminate any possibility that the Commander-in-Chief of the military be influenced by love or hate of a foreign nation. Because this well-established and historically justified reason, we need to think very long and very hard about what's happening in America now. What's happening with the court systems, with the infiltration of foreign law, with this mass movement of people who support foreign law over the Constitution of the United States, over the government seizing up land from the people and taking more power into itself. We only endanger our own liberty when we assume our framers were stupid and they didn't know what they were doing, and that we have some type of advanced intellect that means we can disregard their reasoning for our own personal preferences. We would do well to learn from this history instead of dooming ourselves to repeat history's mistakes. Will we stand up now when we can win without bloodshed? Will we stop this massive transformation of America before there is nothing left to fight for? Educate. Act. Move. God bless. See you tomorrow.